You're listening to WEFT 90.1 FM, and coming up next is a show called The Rift, with the latest news and discussion on today's ecological and climate politics, hosted by Roshan. Coming up next, stay tuned.
Welcome to The Rift, a radio show about climate change, ecology, politics, and power. My name is Roshan Krishnan, and you're listening to WEFT Champaign, 90.1 FM here in East Central Illinois and streaming all over the world at weft.org. Today is Sunday, February 15th, 2026, and this is episode 27 of The Rift. As we in the United States attempt to transition off of fossil fuels, much of the focus is understandably on our ability to build renewable energy technologies and integrate them into our energy, transportation, and building systems. Up until the Trump administration's backlash against renewable energy, energy policy at both the federal level and state level largely focused to varying degrees on incentivizing solar, wind, and battery storage projects. Here in Illinois, our state-level policy still focuses on that. But if we're serious about actually getting off of fossil fuels, we have to acknowledge that right now, our society is enormously dependent on them. Fossil energy systems are deeply intertwined with our infrastructure, our homes, and our way of life. Most of our buildings are heated with natural gas. Much of our electricity comes from gas and coal. Although much has been made of electric vehicles in recent years, the fact is that nearly 99% of vehicles on U.S. roads today are still powered by gasoline. Ultimately, that'll all have to change if we want to live more sustainably. And that means that while we focus on building the new, we also have to tackle what to do with the old. How do we decommission fossil fuel infrastructure safely and in a controlled way that minimizes negative impacts on people, the economy, and the environment? To learn more, I spoke with Emily Grubert, Professor of Sustainable Energy Policy at the University of Notre Dame, and Joshua Lappin, a postdoctoral researcher also at Notre Dame. They've spent years researching these thorny questions about energy transition, and their latest work raises profound questions about what we need to do to plan for a more ecologically and socially healthy future. After the break, you'll hear our conversation about how our fossil fuel systems are more fragile than you might think, and how we need to approach transitioning away from them in a safe and just way. But first, this hour of programming is brought to you in part by That's the Cut Barbershop. Located in Mahomet, That's the Cut is a retro barbershop offering professional haircuts and shaves. That's the Cut Barbershop, 601 East Main Street in Mahomet, 217-855-9673, and on Facebook or the Booksy app. That's the Cut Barbershop. Support for WEFT also comes from Urbana Arts and Culture, providing resources such as arts grants, artist opportunities, events, and other arts and culture programming. Since 2008, the program fosters a city where all residents may engage with the arts, and where artists thrive and are valued. The City of Urbana's Arts and Culture program continues to celebrate Urbana's artistic and cultural diversity. More information can be found at urbanail.gov or on facebook.com/urbanapublicarts. And now, here's my conversation with Emily Grubert and Joshua Lappin. I'm joined now by Emily Grubert, Associate Professor of Sustainable Energy Policy at the University of Notre Dame, and Joshua Lappin, a postdoctoral research associate at the University of Notre Dame. Thanks for joining me, guys.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yeah, happy to be here.
Great. So before we get into all the nitty-gritty of what you're writing about now, could each of you just describe your research and kind of the main thrust of what you work on?
Yeah, absolutely. I'll go first. So my training is as a civil engineer and as an environmental sociologist. And what that basically turns into is me studying how we phase out fossil fuels, primarily in the United States, in a way that supports a much better future for people. So I spend a lot of time thinking about asset exit and social justice issues.
Yeah, and my training is primarily as a historian and then also in the past as an energy systems engineer. So I study very clear overlap with Emily's interests here. I study how energy systems develop over time, how they expand and contract, and how they interconnect with each other.
Great. And yeah, that all sounds like a lot of overlap with the paper that you just co-published, which was in the journal Science. And it's about something that you call the minimum viable scale of fossil-fueled energy systems. And I wonder if you could take a few minutes to just explain what that is, what minimum viable scale is to you, and why you think it's important.
So thanks. I think one of the big points of minimum viable scale, as we lay it out in this paper, is just the acknowledgement that some things can be too small to operate effectively. And so what we're really trying to get at is this notion that when you're looking at really complex systems of systems and networks of networks is the way that we refer to some of these very particular things in the fossil industry, you end up in situations where there might be a point where something is actually too small to continue to provide the services that you expect from it. It's intuitively, it's a little bit like thinking about losing economies of scale. We argue that actually it's worse than just a cost increase. You might actually lose the ability to do something at all. But what we're essentially getting at is you can't, if you have something that's built to provide 100 units of a service, it's not actually necessarily the case that that system will be able to provide one unit of a service. It might be that you get to 50 or 60 units and then suddenly the system cannot go below that point. We lay out a few different reasons this can happen. So maybe the most obvious one is just physical constraints. These are, generally speaking, when we're talking about fossil fuel infrastructure, we're talking about physical assets, like big pipes, big tanks, big processing units, and things like that. Sometimes they just have a minimum throughput. And so you actually have a failure point where you're not supplying enough. The intuition for this that anyone who's worked with water systems might know about is you can actually get to a point where toilets aren't using enough water to actually flush appropriately, and it turns into a massive problem for sewer systems. So stuff like that. We also look at kind of the more typical issues of financial limitations. So you might get to the point where just for financial reasons, you cannot actually afford to go lower than what you're doing, or you need such a major infusion of capital that it's just not really going to happen. And then we think last about managerial constraints, which is essentially a condition where you have a system that cannot be operated as the sort of historical network of networks that it's been built to be, because a lot of that management constraint gets too complicated. And so you might end up in a situation where you have too many people trying to make decisions about assets that depend on each other, and they're not able to coordinate things like that. But those are basically what we think about with minimum viable scale.
And just to offer another intuitive example that I think everyone will likely have encountered in some form in their life that stems from the fossil fuel to energy system. Think about the network of gas stations that makes it possible for people to drive across the country and to carry out their daily mobility needs in a lot of parts of the U.S. We have a series of assumptions about the universal availability of gasoline, and that's maintained by the existence of a lot of different gas stations that all depend on a certain level of market demand. And as market demand for gasoline begins to decline, and gas stations in a very low margin business begin to struggle to remain profitable, there's nothing guaranteeing that the closure of gas stations will take place first in the places where they are least necessary, as opposed to least visited or least profitable. And what this leads to is a scenario in which, at a point when many people are still dependent upon gasoline, we may no longer have a dense enough gas station network to allow everyone to travel everywhere at once. So past a certain threshold, despite the existence still of a very large market for gasoline and a very large number of gas stations, there may not remain a dense enough network that people can rely on this service universally, as we have come to expect over the last century.
Right. And for systems like fossil fuel systems, which are, you know, at this point, incredibly critical to our energy system and our energy needs and really our whole way of life here, for better and mostly for worse, that becomes really crucial, right? And so in the paper, you discuss several examples of this. And the one that really stood out to me is something that we see here in central and southern Illinois with our coal plants and our coal mines. As our coal plants become less economical to run, often due to increasing environmental regulations or the natural gas boom that's made gas so much cheaper, they've been, you know, shutting down units of each coal plant and operating at reduced capacity. And all of a sudden, that makes the mines that supply them less viable. And suddenly you've got a bunch of miners out of a job when the mine closes. That is kind of a, I don't want to say smaller scale, because it's a huge impact here in the state. It's one of the things that, you know, I spend my working days worrying about. But you guys talk about some of these other examples about like oil refineries, about the enormity of the natural gas pipeline infrastructure, as well as coal power plants and mines. So could you talk a little bit more about this idea now as applied to our actual fossil fuel infrastructure and how that is kind of showing up these days?
Yeah, and let me just start by saying too, it's so interesting to hear that you're actually seeing this sort of plant closure drives mine closure issues. I've been thinking about this in a couple of different localities for the last 6 or 7 years and kind of waiting to see it start to happen. So it's really interesting that that's something that felt familiar to you, because I've kind of gone from conversations where people are like, that's a ridiculous claim, to situations like you saying, yeah, actually we can see that happening. So I think that's maybe one of the other messages about this paper. A lot of the things that we're suggesting might happen seem kind of far-fetched until all of a sudden they're happening. And so a big part of what we're trying to do with this research is call people's attention to it and basically say, you actually can plan around this stuff if you know it's coming, and we are pretty sure it's coming, or it's at least likely enough that you need to pay attention to it. But yeah, in terms of some of the other examples, Josh and I are actually pretty embedded in the conversation around refineries because we've been working out in California in the context of a couple of those big facilities closing over the last several months and into the next few months. But basically, we start to see situations where facilities just are claiming that they can't continue to operate for whatever reason. Sometimes they're not super explicit about why. Sometimes they make claims about why that might not really quite match what we might expect from a more theoretical perspective. So, you know, is it actually environmental regulation or is it that your facility is 130 years old? You know, things like that that can get a little bit hairy to track down sometimes. But that's a situation where we're really starting to see some physical constraints that we think are going to be really, really important in refineries in general. So the intuition here that I think is maybe fairly easy to understand is that because refineries make multiple fuels, they actually do have to continue to produce those multiple products in order to operate as they were designed to. So if you have really, really different levels of demand decline in one versus another, the classical example in the climate space basically being that we expect gasoline demand to fall faster than airplane fuel demand, basically, that makes it really difficult to operate in the way that you were designed to. I think one of the points that Josh makes a lot is that you can have some of these physical constraints be overcome by money. Like you could reinvest in the facility, like just change the way that it actually works, build something new, maybe. But in a declining space, we maybe don't expect that either. And so we do expect to see a lot of challenges in the refining sector as these kind of multiple products move separately in terms of when we expect to phase them out.
Yeah. And just to put an additional angle on that point about the way that money can but likely won't overcome some of these thresholds of minimum viable scale that we're defining, because of the ways in which the entire fossil fuel sector is interconnected and ownership is often overlapping, vertical integration takes different forms and is differentially complete in different areas. Sometimes the question of financial minimum viable scale isn't even a question of bare profitability, but rather a question of relative profitability. And as the portions of this network of networks, as we like to say, that are either most carefully and attentively regulated or are subject to the most competition, either from within the sector or from new non-fossil alternatives, as those sectors become less profitable, there will be, and we are already seeing in some cases, there already is a race by different operators to leave those unprofitable portions of the overall industry behind and move into the more profitable refuges. But from the standpoint of a consumer and a society that depends on all of these energy services for economic productivity, but also for health and safety, people leaving behind some portions of a system that is all interconnected really isn't an acceptable midterm outcome.
Yeah, this is giving me kind of two follow-up questions, and I think I'll just stick with the first one for now, which is, I suppose I don't hear about it quite as much these days, perhaps because we're less focused federally on actually drawing down fossil fuel usage, at least nominally. But, you know, I feel like a few years ago, there was some attention being brought to the oil industry kind of turning its attention more than it already was to plastics, right? And trying to increase its material throughput into the plastics industry, in part due to an anticipation of decreased usage of oil for applications that are, you know, going through the refineries or going into your automobile. Where do you think that kind of fits into all of this, if it does?
Yeah, that's a great question. I love this story, actually, because I think there's so many things going on. But yeah, the sort of refocus into chemicals and plastics and things like that has been fairly noticeable, at least from a communications perspective from the industry. I think one of the things that actually is also really interesting about assessing refinery transition is that some refineries are also chemical complexes or plastics inputs complexes, and some of them aren't. And so how they get affected really does depend on their product mix. The plastics thing in particular, I find really interesting. And, you know, as a civil engineer, I'm probably a little bit of an infrastructural determinist on this one, but my understanding is that a lot of the reason for the big turn to plastics has been because of a lot of the way that fracked gas reservoirs include particular components that weren't as common before. So like one of the things that I think becomes really clear when you start studying the refining business and the chemicals production business is that people are actually really good at figuring out how to use byproducts. So there's a kind of asterisk good news here is that some of the products that are actually difficult to keep producing without having big petroleum refineries are things that we probably wouldn't use but for the fact that we have this product that we need to do something with. So sulfur kind of being an example. But with the plastics production in particular, there are a few natural gas fields that really got very, very large after the fracking boom that have high ethane content that, again, my understanding is imperfect on this, but some of the bid to plastics has been a way to use this byproduct that didn't have much of a market and turn it into a fairly high margin product that could then take advantage of this widely available feedstock that was kind of aligned with the way that production was going. And so it is absolutely a situation where you see industry going towards something that they think is going to stick around for a little bit longer, but it's also sort of an opportunistic usage of a flow that we had within the system that didn't exist before. So I think the story is a little bit more complicated than, like, we don't think transportation fuels are going to be doing it, but nonetheless, I think it is really interesting to watch that the more challenged facilities tend to be the ones that don't have these very, very high margin alternatives.
Got it. And yeah, I think the other question that I was thinking about relative to your prior answer, you know, you were kind of talking about especially like utility operators, grid operators getting out of unprofitable industries, you know, maybe a bit before they kind of really hit their nadir, right? Like people want to get out while they can. And I think about that a lot in relation to gas. You know, what we're seeing with coal plants is, I don't want to directly compare it to what might happen with gas because, you know, in part what's happening with coal is caused by the surge in shale drilling and the advent of fracking. At the same time, if we are to, you know, at some point in the hypothetical future, get serious about moving off of gas, I think a lot of sort of discourses around energy systems people tend to still kind of hew to this, like, okay, well, it's going to get outcompeted and we'll see what happens idea. And it's hard for me not to think about all of the cascading failures that we see happening with coal and that we've seen happening with the decline of coal for decades now. And it's been this kind of slow motion crash for tons and tons of people.
We've got We have a manuscript you're absolutely going to love.
Yeah, I guess the question is like, is it reasonable to fear that for gas as well?
I mean, yes, definitely. And the original thing that brought Emily and I together more than a decade ago now was that both of us were working on coal. And I think people, as Emily said, there's a manuscript in progress here that is a kind of cri de coeur. But people who are familiar with what's happened to the coal industry take a different perspective to the kind of Pollyanna-ish claims that get made about the likely futures of the oil and gas industry. I think there are a lot of reasons to expect that absent changes in policy regimes, the present and recent past decades of coal are the likely future of oil and gas in a lot of key ways. And in particular, looking at the way in which the private sector has been left to manage decline and has largely declined to do so. And as a result, decline has been managed through bankruptcy. And that's a disaster for local communities, for workers, for shareholders even, and it generally leads to non-optimal outcomes for everyone together. So I think we should really look not only with a lot of concern, but also with a strong sense of foreknowledge at what coal is going through, because coal's situation actually echoes other examples of industrial decline. It's not even that coal is a good mirror for the rest of the fossil fuel industry, but coal is kind of a standard model of what happens to industries that aren't carefully centrally planned with public interest in mind as they begin to diminish.
I feel like every time I talk about coal decline, I basically am like putting a flashlight underneath my chin and making spooky ghost noises. But like genuinely, it's a really, really important precedent because like Josh says, there's no real reason to believe that things would be better for oil and gas. And as I like to say, the oil and gas industries are much bigger in the United States. And so when we're talking about, I mean, at this point, recognizing, of course, that the coal industry has gone through a massive, massive decline that's been extraordinarily harmful in multiple parts of the country. At this point, we're talking about total employment generously of maybe about 50,000 people. When you look out to oil and gas, it's several hundred thousand, which is still, frankly, enough. It's a small enough number that we could really start to think about some really interesting policy interventions. Like, this is not a situation where we're needing to manage the jobs of half of the working adult population in the United States. Nonetheless, it's much bigger than what we've seen with coal, and what we've seen with coal has been pretty disastrous. I want to come back to the gas thing too for a second, because when I was reaching out to Josh to maybe come work with me on this project, one of the things that I've been obsessed with a little bit for a while is how we think about gas phase out and some of these minimum scale issues there particularly. And specifically, I think what's different about natural gas versus coal or oil is that it provides really different energy services across a number of different sectors. Transportation at its core is an oil thing, and oil is at its core a transportation thing. There are a few other products that turn out to be important. These feedstock issues are relevant, but basically almost all of the oil is used for transportation. For coal, similarly, there are a couple of exceptions like steel, water filtration, stuff like that. But by and large, this is an electricity thing. Once you get into gas, you're talking about home heating, you're talking about industrial users, you're talking about power, and it turns out that there's actually a relatively consistent distribution across those things. So it's sort of 30% heating, 30% industrial, 40% power. And I think when we start thinking about minimum viable scale, one of the things that really worries me is, as with the refining sector, there are ways that these different uses actually sort of cross-subsidize each other, and if you want to use that language, in the sense that, you know, if you have a pipeline that is supporting all three of those users and one of the uses goes away but the other two don't, you still have to pay for the pipeline. And so that kind of thing suggests that we may get to the point where, yeah, like, no one can pay for the pipeline anymore, but that doesn't mean that the users are done yet. But I think that that really does present a bit of a unique case relative to oil or coal that are sort of single sector issues for the most part.
Right. And not only that, what I was going to say is that we don't have, not to nearly the same extent, we don't have people burning coal and oil in their homes. We don't have a pipeline and infrastructure servicing single family homes, multifamily homes, like that whole apparatus. You know, if that goes away, that's work. That's a whole body of work, and that's a whole safety issue. And, you know, that sort of gets me into what I wanted to talk about next, which is that, you know, generally speaking to this point, we have not been very good at managing fossil fuel infrastructure after its useful life. I'm thinking specifically of the hundreds of thousands of orphaned oil and gas drilling wells that we have across the U.S. and the, you know, to this point, I think it's fair to say pretty inadequate efforts we've made to treat them and prevent pollution and contamination of groundwater and that sort of thing. And so getting into, you know, some of the proposed solutions that you talk about in your paper, you know, how do we prevent a similar outcome with some of this other fossil fuel infrastructure? And are there any lessons that you can take from what we have and haven't done to this point?
Yeah, I think that the case of oil and gas extraction is really illustrative in a couple of ways. One thing I was going to say in answer to the previous question that's relevant here too is learning from coal and to a lesser extent oil and gas extraction. These are actually sectors that within the pretty vitiated context of U.S. remediation law, these are actually sectors with more legal heft behind them. And we've seen that be totally inadequate when we look to something like the gas pipelining industry, or especially to petroleum refineries. What we see is a sector with far less legal protection when we get into the afterlives, which we're now beginning to talk about here with oil and gas wells. So thinking about what's happened in industry environments where there's a relatively strong set of legal protections and how inadequate that has proven should really raise our sense of alarm when we're moving into confronting some of these other sectors. I think one of the interesting things that we can learn from the decline of oil and gas wells in particular is that dealing with the complex and sometimes really massive unfunded liabilities that are produced by energy infrastructure is not always the cut and dried red and blue political issue that we would expect. One thing Emily likes to observe pretty frequently is that the states that have multi-generational experience with declining energy extraction regimes are often the states that have put in place the strongest protections. And so looking to states like Wyoming, which find themselves in some ways in better position than the states like California in terms of ensuring that operators reserve at least a modicum of money to help fund the cleanup of their wells, suggests that there's an untapped political opportunity here to communicate with people about what's coming in the future by building those arguments off of what communities have already experienced in the past. And I think this goes to the broader thing I want to observe here, that we can see in all of these examples of orphaning or industrial decline that's been unmanaged and leaves behind remediation liabilities, is that planning and discussing the problem in advance is really critical for building the political will to do something about it. And one of the problems we've had in doing so in the oil and gas case is that because the industry has overall existed in this narrative of an indefinite future, it's been relatively easy for them to say that instances of orphaning or of inadequate remediation are due to bad actors. It doesn't need necessarily a structural policy response. Future industry profits will doubtless take care of it. And that argument played over and over again has allowed millions of wells to accumulate on public ledgers, de facto public ledgers. That conversation is now beginning to change as more and more people can see an end date for these industries. So making sure to begin to push on this immediately in this window where we can all see what's coming, but it hasn't yet completely arrived, is the best we can do for trying to ensure that there's more opportunity to make the industry responsible for its own cleanup before it's no longer able to finance it.
Yeah, and in terms of what do we do, like, I think one of the things that is really hard about doing this work is just the fact that it is really, really hard. Like, I think we get a lot, you know, all these policy proposals seem like they're going to be really difficult to achieve. What do you say to that? And it's like, yeah, they are. We could also just fail. Like, so we might as well try. And I think one of the things that comes up for us a lot is just thinking about what is the recommendation here? Where I have landed after doing this kind of work in a bunch of different sectors and a bunch of different spaces for a pretty long time is that at this point, what you really need to do is commit to an outcome on basically fossil phase out and stick to that, first of all. But also, I think what really becomes important when we start talking about infrastructure transition, when you still have people using these services, is just to have a really, really coordinated sense of exactly when things are closing, what order they're closing in, and how you are going to manage that. Where that's led me is to think that there is really not an option other than some sort of public management and probably public ownership structure here. I think Josh was just alluding to the point that when you have things close chaotically based on individual asset owner decisions, the public already owns the liability that comes along with that. Like, whether that's in a direct way because you have to clean up contaminated land or an indirect way because you've got a bunch of people out of work and struggling communities, the public already owns the negative part of this. To the extent that there's some way to really control how do we think we're moving forward, how do we make sure that there are services available to replace what we're losing as we do retire this fossil infrastructure, and then how do we make that predictable for people so that we can make good decisions? I think at the policy level, we often talk about making decisions that the states can act on or that the country can act on, but I'm also talking about situations like, you know, if you work at a particular facility and you're trying to decide whether you're going to get a mortgage on a new house or something like that, like, you'd probably like to know if the big anchor industry in your town is going to retire in the next 3 years. So this can be very localized decisions too. But I think really getting a handle on when, what order, and what is replacing it is really the call to public ownership and public management that we've been looking to. And I want to say too, just up front, like, recognizing it's super hard and it's super challenged, I have so much respect for what Illinois is doing in this regard, because I think it's one of the only examples in the U.S. that's actually tried to commit to some deadlines for these things. So thinking not just about a deadline on an emissions level, which plenty of states have, you know, we want to be net zero by whenever, but Illinois actually saying, like, we need to close the coal plants by 2035 for the most part, or we need to actually acquire these next kinds of services in some way by a date. Like, that is something that most places don't do. And so as much as I wish that it was easier and more effective, like I really do respect everything that's going on in Illinois on that front.
Oh, man, I don't want to be a buzzkill about this.
I know.
For now. You know, it's proving difficult, I will say that. But, I mean, you did actually kind of snipe my next question, which was about more or less about the idea of public ownership, right? These are super complex systems, not just technically and logistically, but as we've talked about, financially. And one of the things, especially in the electric and gas utility space, is that the question of ownership and profit and, you know, how these utility companies make their money, how generators do, how distribution utilities do, how that's all regulated. It's this Byzantine patchwork that is incredibly different from state to state, even going down to who owns various pieces of the infrastructure, distribution lines, transmission lines, generating facilities. And so the idea of public ownership of energy, that's something that's been growing in popularity among climate activists. I've talked to a few for this show who are advocates of public power, and they're largely concerned about, yes, meeting those deadlines, but also a lot of the time just having the freedom, I suppose, to actually build renewable energy to the extent that's necessary to power our daily lives. But public ownership for the express purpose of managed decline, right? That seems like a bit of a different beast. What is there anything, I guess, since we've already sort of established that that is something that you think is worth talking about, do you think that that's kind of its own distinct thing, or how do you think of it in relation to owning things publicly to build versus to shut down?
Yeah, no, I think that's such a good question, because I think about this a lot, actually. So our paper kind of gets at this a bit, but I also have a good bit of work with Meejin Cha on what this might look like as we think about coal specifically, and thinking about how you would demonstrate that basically public ownership for managed decline could work. But one of the things that I think that we think about a lot on the public ownership for decline side that is pretty distinct from the just general question of whether these things should be owned in service to the public, in trust for the public, is basically the notion of coordination. And I think that that's the strongest differential argument for the decline side. Like, I'm pretty pro public ownership in general, and I really do take the point that like buying a bunch of stuff in order to lose a bunch of money on it is kind of a challenging argument. But I think what we basically try to argue is, again, like the public already owns these liabilities. The public should have the ability to control how bad they get and also how they really unfold. Because right now, basically, what we see is that private actors are able to make decisions based on their localized self-interest and maybe their legal self-interest, actually, in a lot of cases, too. Like fiduciary duty is a real thing in these cases. What we suggest is that for public safety reasons, as well as a myriad of other reasons related to environmental outcomes and all sorts of cost issues and things like that, you really do need to coordinate this transition. Like, that is not optional if you don't want to have major service continuity losses and things like that. What that ends up meaning is you actually need some way to compel certain assets to stay open sometimes. And there's really not a way to do that without some sort of public management that probably looks a lot like public ownership. Like I'm being a little cagey here because I've heard the argument that you could have essentially all of the managerial benefits of ownership without full transfer. And maybe there's some advantages there in terms of liability for past environmental harms. But in this sort of colloquial way, public ownership in the sense that the public is responsible for making all operational choices and closure versus open choices, the ability to compel something to stay open is something that you cannot do basically with incentives. I think the other thing that shows up that is just not possible without some sort of public coordinating function is just that coordination itself. So like what we see right now is that in a lot of these industries, when they are set up to be competitive, which is mostly what we see in the refining space because those aren't regulated as utilities, they're actually not legally allowed to coordinate. This is antitrust stuff. And so if you think about the idea of, you know, I have 10 refineries and I need two of them to be open for 30 years, but I need the other ones to shut down so that we can start post-closure things and actually think about what we might do with this land in the future or something like that, they actually can't have that conversation. A public regulator can, but you can't actually really do much with that unless you have the ability to decide who stays open, who closes, and when.
Yeah. And just returning to this point of needing to secure the ability to keep something open, to compel operation, we have tons of examples from the past in the U.S. and abroad. When a critical life safety energy service like the ones we're talking about here suddenly stops operating, the government will make sure that it operates, right? There's an obligation that's both political and just goes to the core of state legitimacy. And we can either do that by setting up these structures to ensure that in advance, and these look like public management, they look like new obligations on operators, or we can scramble in the midst of an emergency to figure out how to get these systems back online, with the caveat that a lot of the ways that they might go offline if they approach minimum viable scale could be really damaging, right? We're talking about explosions and fires, the types of industrial accidents that actually make it impossible to rapidly restart a facility. One of the examples that we've both been thinking about quite a bit as an analogy to some of the kind of more heavy industry pieces of the fossil energy system is steelmaking, primary steelmaking. And there are several examples around the world, most recently and kind of dramatically in the UK, where the closure of, or the imminent closure of the final blast furnace in the country has led to intervention by the military and even the transport of coking coal by Royal Navy ships in order to guarantee that this national security capacity isn't lost. I don't think anyone in that environment thinks that the Royal Navy transporting coal is an optimal outcome. It's tremendously expensive. They were gambling. They really, by the skin of their teeth, kept that facility open. And it still remains unclear how liabilities are going to be transferred between the state and the previous and still quasi-private owners. All of this can be resolved by putting in place the structures of public ownership in advance and taking these things into coordinated management before the emergency case, when we will bring them into public management regardless. It's a matter of timing and of having this conversation when people aren't in a fight or flight crisis response frame of mind. The other thing I wanted to add really quickly, I said at the beginning that I come at this primarily as a historian, and a lot of my historical research is on different forms of ownership of energy systems over time and stretching back into the 19th century. And one thing that's often missing in a lot of the contemporary conversations that mention public ownership and mention it with a sense of trepidation as a kind of strange and un-American form is that there's public ownership of energy systems all around us in the United States. And many, many different generations of thought and policy design have shaped a variety of different options. I'm certainly not going to hold up any of those options as perfect and ideal, but we actually have a lot more capacity to learn from our own history here in the United States than I think people tend to assume we do. A really significant amount of power, and not just electrical power, but energy of all kinds, is produced, processed, delivered, used by public entities. And beginning to think through what those different entities can offer us in the particular case where we're trying to gradually phase out a system is a project that can't get started soon enough.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I feel like what we're talking about here is actually sort of reframing a little bit the way that I've been thinking about how things are going in Illinois. And, you know, a few minutes ago, I was pretty doom and gloom, and I kind of still am, but it's kind of fascinating because I think it opens up this new line of inquiry, which is that, yeah, here in Illinois, we are having that conversation right now about what do we need to keep open to make sure that we have resource adequacy. That's the big discussion right now, is that the Illinois Power Agency, which is our, if I describe it simply, it's sort of the state agency that's responsible for planning around our renewable energy goals in the state. They commissioned a resource adequacy study to essentially say, hey, like, Can we actually meet these deadlines that we've set for ourselves while also not leaving people without power, right? And the result has been essentially like kind of not really, but it's also heavily influenced by the proliferation of data centers, right? And the enormous projected energy costs by the RTOs and ISOs for all of these data centers, which is this fascinating collision of public planning and private interest that nobody really voted for, right? Like, and so I think that seems like something that, regardless of whether there is public ownership or not, as long as we have capitalist enterprise around, that's something that's going to be kind of coming into conflict. And you know, kind of on that note, we're going on probably a few decades of the dominant narrative being that renewable energy outcompeting fossil fuels on the market is kind of what we need to transition off of fossil fuels. And notwithstanding that the economics of power generation and actually building renewables have proven that to be a little more complicated. but reading your paper and having this conversation, I think what it also highlights is that that approach leaves a lot of people in the lurch. There's a bunch of stranded infrastructure. There's potentially a bunch of job loss. There's social upheaval. And even looking at some kind of scenario where we do implement far greater public regulations, we do have these kind of really difficult to anticipate and govern around sort of shocks and developments like the AI boom that's causing, you know, energy demand to increase for the first time in who knows when. I feel like the question that I'm approaching is kind of just too big at this point. Yeah. But how do we do it? I mean, I guess like how do you think about like that balance, knowing that we are not going to move to central planning in a in a snap of the fingers?
Yeah. I think, and let me maybe disclose again, this is a Friday night and I'm feeling very very righteous about a lot of these things. But no, it's a really good question. And I think one of the things that comes to mind for me every time these conversations happen, and again, like I'm in Northern Indiana, we've got a huge data center proliferation situation ourselves just right out of town. And my general reaction to these kinds of questions, which are genuinely challenging, is basically that if we actually are committed to the project of decarbonization, like we need to be so much more visionary about this than I think we're seeing. Like basically, when you look at models for what it would take to actually electrify people's heat, people's mobility, all these kinds of things, 50 gigawatts of data center demand, like it's a rounding error. Like, we're talking about terawatts of build-out over the next 25 years if we actually meet these goals. And so just, I think this kind of comes back to something earlier in the conversation where it's, yeah, this is all really, really hard. And again, recognizing that what's going on in Illinois right now is not all roses, but I have so much respect that people are actually even trying. But it's, I think it's a situation where we just have to recognize that the future of what this looks like has to be different from what the past has looked like. And when we think about what that means from a governance perspective, like this goes beyond just public management in the sense that we've maybe historically seen it and really starts to look like something where we have to change institutional structures in order to get to where we're going. So one example, like I think that there's a legitimate conversation to be had over whether a public entity should allow certain kinds of demand to come online and really thinking about what it means to prioritize things. Like, I have a lot of family in Texas, and so was pretty engaged with the Uri issues a few years ago when the grid almost came down and during an ice storm. And one of the things that I think was really on a lot of people's minds after that particular event, after having seen, you know, Central District Austin with all the lights on and then people freezing to death in their houses right outside the city, right, is like, how do you actually prioritize who gets things? Somebody has to make that decision. It's a really, really tricky thing to do. What we do right now is basically some sort of quasi, we don't have the circuit density to be able to tell you how to do anything. And if you can pay for it, you can have it. That's not, I mean, that is a choice about how we prioritize things, and we could make different ones. And so thinking about like, what is actually the institutional capacity that we need, not just to build terawatts of capacity to make sure that people do have access to these services, but also to say, no, like, it's really hot right now, data center has to turn off, or we're not actually going to let you do that because we don't think that it's in the best interest of society for this thing to exist, like whether that's a data center or something else. Like, those are the kinds of things you could engage that we haven't traditionally, in the last sort of neoliberal turn era at least, really done that much of. But like, these are legitimate public planning questions that go well beyond just like, we have to meet whatever demand comes our way under all circumstances.
Yeah, and just to kind of put a point on that, we already in our energy delivery systems already all the time tell people they can't have energy, right? It's in the form of utility shutoffs. The question is, who do we tell that they can't have energy? Who are we willing to say no to? And right now we just allow the market to mediate that, right? It's a question of what you can pay for, but we've got bigger and deeper societal problems here than what can be paid for.
Yeah, I, you know, it's funny. I remember those pictures of downtown Austin lit up during the ice storm, and I remember, you know, people who do know a lot about the grid saying, well, you know, this is commercial infrastructure. It's on a different system, and I remember thinking, well, someone decided that, you know,
yeah, you could decide something else.
Yeah, as it turns yeah. Out. Like, so as it very often ends up on this show, the answer is simply that we have to transform society.
Yeah, solidarity. Like, this is something where there are a lot of benefits to a lot of people if we do a good job. It's a real struggle and it's really, really hard. But yeah, like, we can't meet climate and justice goals without some sort of transformation.
Yeah, and just to return to the message that we hope people take away from our most recent research here, there are a lot of ethical reasons that we need to do this differently. But what we believe our research shows is that even if you were willing to set those aside, we're no longer on a path that's going to work without significant intervention, right? And the worst of all worlds, in a lot of ways, is a failed energy transition. And we don't want to get one third of the way through and then have systemic infrastructural collapses make it politically or logistically or financially impossible to continue carrying through. And so when it comes to the concerns that you articulated, that I feel every day, that all of this is so far beyond our political grasp right now in this country, I think one of the ways through that is to get better at articulating the path that we're actually on. Do we want the National Guard delivering and rationing gasoline? I think that's a more likely status quo future than anything else for us right now. I don't want that. I think that is a radical and extreme and disturbing outcome, and it's the one we're headed for. So I think we struggle a lot in all sorts of different parts of the climate and energy world to articulate the ways in which the future is going to be different from our baseline expectations, because we have spent generations in this country, the vast majority of us, but not all of us, with a set of background subconscious assumptions about the instantaneous and universal availability of energy. And we're no longer headed for that world. And so being able to articulate that it takes public collective action now to put ourselves on the least harm pathway, I think there are a lot of ways to do that in which that get people motivated and engaged and committed and concerned. And what doesn't work is framing this all as just a question of marginal affordability, and the future will look the same as now, but maybe your car won't have a tailpipe, and otherwise you're never going to be inconvenienced. It's not true, and I think people resent when they're lied to, and we need to start talking about what the future actually looks like so that we can reduce the difficulty politically of imagining alternatives to that. As Emily said, riled up on a Friday night.
Yeah, well, I mean, we love talking about societal upheaval on this show. That's kinda, that's the point, you know. It's called The Rift for a reason. But yeah, I mean, this has been a really fascinating conversation. You know, so glad that you guys could take the time to join me here. But as we kind of push up against time here, just want to know how people can kind of follow your continued work and, you know, what you might be up to next.
Yeah. We're both, I think, pretty findable online. We're both on Blue Sky for particularly, but also like happy to field emails if people are interested. I tend to put up my publications, including this one, as just PDFs at emilygrubert.org/publications. So if people want to read it, head over there if you don't have institutional access. But yeah, we're hoping to put out some really neat stuff that really starts to operationalize some of this over the next year or so. So we really appreciate the opportunity to come on. And yeah, thanks to everybody who's working super hard on this kind of stuff. It's not easy.
All right. Well, Emily Grubert, Associate Professor of Sustainable Energy Policy at Notre Dame, and Josh Lappin, Postdoctoral Researcher also at Notre Dame. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
That was my conversation with Emily Grubert and Joshua Lappin of the University of Notre Dame. The paper that they just published is called Fossil Energy Minimum Viable Scale. And as Emily mentioned, you can find it on her website if you don't want to go through the incredibly restrictive academic publishing infrastructure. I want to thank them both again for taking the time to come on the show today. You know, I'm really grateful for the work that people like Emily and Josh are doing, because to be frank, we just aren't thinking about it enough in so many ways. The way that we've organized our energy systems and really our society is all but antithetical to the very concept of controlled planning for the future and being able to take care of everyone. And speaking for myself, it seems to me that many people working in clean energy or energy policy don't necessarily want to think about the questions that Emily and Josh are working on, because those questions reveal the full extent to which things will need to change. That can be tough to accept, especially at a time when that change feels so far away, when we're in a really difficult political moment. But I really believe that if we lie to ourselves about the scope of the transformation that's needed to address ecological breakdown, we're setting ourselves up for failure. And so once again, I really appreciate Emily and Josh for their work in foregrounding those difficult questions and their difficult answers. So that's it for today's show. As always, thank you so much for listening to The Rift on WEFT 90.1 FM, community radio from Champaign, Illinois. The recording of this episode will be online later this evening, and you'll be able to access it on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or various aggregators of your choosing if you go to linktree.com/theriftradio. Up next on WEFT, it's On the Move with Herbert Burnett. The next episode of The Rift will be on Sunday, March 1st. Until then, take care. My idea, I hope you know that we're gonna have this.
it simple, keep the same crowd, we're on the inside.